hope for under the circumstances.
Victor takes a deep breath and releases it slowly. He fiddles with the brass buttons on his jacket for a moment, then says,
It pains me to leave you unprotected. I don't like the whispers coming from Petrograd.
Nicholas will be here soon. Everything will be fine once we're all together again. Please, don't create trouble for yourself or your men. I don't want anyone's son sent before a firing squad on our account.
The guard asked me to pass along their sentiments. They remain loyal in their hearts. Please do not judge them for leaving.
I judge no one other than those cadets from Stalker you brought in to play with Alexei last month. One of them infected him with the measles, and now Olga and Tatiana are ill as well. The words are harsh, but she says them with a smile. Viktor Zborovsky looks to Mother for absolution, and she grants it in her own way, rising from her chair beside the fire and crossing to a small sideboard, where she chooses a hand-painted icon of Saint Anna of Kashan, holy protector of women, and places it in his hands. Take this as a sign of my gratitude, she says, and then whispers so low that I almost don't hear, You know what to do with it. Victor wraps the icon in his kerchief and tucks it inside his coat.
They let me in through the main entrance. Everything else, apart from a side door in the kitchen, has been locked and sealed. Guards are stationed at all the doors, and the first floor windows are nailed shut. Anyone in your court who wishes to leave will have to go through the main entrance, and they will be required to give their names and their relationship to your household. All the information given will be recorded. I'm sorry for that. There is nothing I can do.
You have done enough. Take your men to safety. Mother and I stand at the window once again, more aware than ever of how completely we have been separated from everything on the other side of the wall. We watch as Victor gathers the men of the Imperial Guard and marches them from the palace in orderly ranks. We watch as our beloved soldiers and friends are replaced by 300 strangers who are loyal to a regime that hates us. What did you put in that icon, Mother? She smiles. Oh, you are a clever girl. It wasn't just a gift, was it? No, it was a message. What sort? The sort I hope we do not need. A disconcerting silence falls between us again, as the soldiers of the first rifles are being ordered about in the courtyard. After a moment I say, At least one good thing came of this. Is that so? We are going to England. Are we? You don't believe him? Mother motions to the cobblestone courtyard below, where an artillery gun is being wheeled across the stones and aimed toward the house. And there behind it stand 100 men and their wall of bayonets. I suspect that part was a lie, she says.
Chapter 3. Anna. Departure. 1968. Neuenburg, Germany, August. Anna wakes in the hospital. She knows immediately that she has been drugged because she has to pull herself up and out of the fog to work at keeping her eyes open and her mind clear. This is an old, unpleasant and unwelcome sensation. The difference this time is that she comes to not in an asylum but in a hospital. There is no screaming, no crying. It smells of antiseptic instead of urine. And she is in a room by herself instead of in an open ward. It is as though she's surfacing head first from the bottom of a deep, dark pool. Anna can think before she can move her limbs. The result is a brief, suffocating panic in which she fears she is paralyzed. But within moments, the rest of her body begins to cooperate, and she is once again able to wiggle fingers and toes. Anna feels the IV in the back of her left hand. This sight is stiff and sore. She peels off the tape and pulls the needle from her skin. There is a brief, cool, bizarre feeling as it slips out of her vein, like someone has drawn a sliver of ice from beneath her skin. Two bags hang from the stand beside her bed, one large and filled with glucose, and the other small and empty. Anna guesses the latter to be a sedative. Her clothes are folded in neat little rectangles on the chair beside the bed, her shoes perched on top. The hospital gown she wears is clean and white and buttons up the back. They've removed her undergarments as well, which means they've seen the worst of her scars. This violation of her privacy never gets easier. It is bad enough that the eyes of strangers are always drawn to the thin, silvery lines at her temple and collarbones. But those are small and curious compared to the jagged, puckered scars on her torso and thighs. Her visible scars suggest there might be an interesting story involved. But the ones hidden beneath her clothes tell the grisly truth of what happened to her all those years ago. It is why she does not willingly allow others to see her naked. There is simply no way to explain, and she cannot tolerate the pity that comes with their discovery. Anna swings her feet lightly over the side of the bed and places them on the cold floor. She tests her balance, and when she's certain that the drugs have faded from her system, she stands. She is clothed in moments, each article jerked onto her thin frame with little attention paid to tags and buttons, or concern for neatness. She cares only about having her armor in place once again. So when a nurse enters several minutes later, she finds Anna standing at the window, arms crossed, as though prepared for battle. "You're awake." The nurse is young and plain, but absurdly cheerful.
"Where am I?" Anna demands.
"The district hospital at Neuenberg."
"Why?"
"They found you unconscious and brought you here."
"They?"
"The paramedics. You're on the floor, unresponsive."
"No," Anna says. "They drugged me."
The nurse hesitates, then smiles. It's meant to be a reassuring gesture.
"Only because you resisted."
"Who wouldn't resist being drugged?"
"You resisted coming here."
Now a tight-lipped smirk.
"How could I do such a thing if I was unconscious?"
Anna knows what she looks like, a somewhat senile and helpless old woman in her early 70s. But this young nurse has just realized the incongruence between her appearance and her intellect, and is adjusting accordingly. This time the smile she offers Anna is one of concession.
"Would you like me to fetch the doctor? I'm sure you have questions."
"Yes." If Anna had a franc for every doctor she has seen over the years, for every unwanted examination and every question evaded, she would be a very wealthy woman. In the early years, the exams sent her into a feral panic. Episodes, the doctors call them. But it has been decades since that happened. She is no longer afraid of doctors. They are all the same to her at this point. Anna doesn't even bother asking the name of this one. She glares at him when he enters the small, sterile room.
"I would like to be taken home."
"I'm afraid that's not possible." He sits on the chair, recently occupied by her clothing.
"You need rest and care."
"And?"
"And what?"
"The real reason you're keeping me here. What is it?"
"There is no other reason. You've been ill."
She glances out the window, looks at the sky.
"How long have I been here?"
A long pause.
3 days.
There is an immediate uptick in her pulse. A rage begins to settle in her core.
"You've kept me drugged for 3 days?"
He opens his mouth, closes it. He is wise in the end not to answer her question at all. Anna does not argue or interrogate him. She stands very quiet and straight and still. This unexpected silence does exactly what she intends. The doctor begins to fidget.
"Your heart is perfectly healthy. We were concerned. Needlessly. Why am I here?"
Seeing no way around it, he admits the truth.
"Your dasha is being cleaned."
It is interesting that he uses the word dasha, the Russian word for cottage. Perhaps this is some attempt at sympathy, a way to ingratiate himself or to acknowledge her identity. It doesn't matter. She would have preferred a diagnosis of cancer to this. Anything, really. While she has been sedated in this hospital, strangers have been rummaging through her things, looking at years' worth of papers and documents and legal filings. They can see anything. They can take anything. Sometimes rage is hot and explosive, but other times it is cool and sharp and vicious, and she directs the pointed end of it directly at this idiot doctor. "You will release me from this facility," she says. "You will arrange immediate transportation for my return to Unterlangenhardt, and you will not, under any circumstances, release details of my condition or my stay to anyone."
"This is a mistake. You really should..."
"I am not here under psychiatric observation, correct?" Noting the slight shake of his head, she continues, "Nor do I have any pressing health issues. This is my decision. You are obligated by law to release me." He offers bristling acknowledgement that she is, in fact, right. "You know who I am."
"Yes, Fräulein Anderson."
Anderson. It's not her real name, of course, merely one she had to assume in order to leave Germany 40 years ago. And yet it sticks, as do the recriminations that come along with it. "Then you know that I have excellent attorneys." He nods. "Good. Prepare my release papers immediately." Unterlangenhardt has been Anna's home for decades, and even though she doesn't love it the way she loves Wasserburg or Paris, it is familiar and comfortable. A soft landing place. And while she has never claimed to be a good housekeeper, or shown interest in being one for that matter, she does realize that others find her clutter alarming. They call it hoarding and chaos. Sometimes they use other, more offensive words, but what they do not understand is that it gives her the ability to remain invisible and to hide what she does not want seen. The boxes and piles and stacks distract the relentless stream of visitors from noticing things she would rather keep hidden. A photo album filled with pictures of the imperial family, an ivory chess set, a penknife with a golden crest, and the small hand-painted icon of St. Anna of Kashin. Mainly, though, people take issue with the cats. There are so many. Half of them identical, long-haired and bright orange, as though they've sprung right out of a malfunctioning copy machine. They breed faster than Anna can control. There are always more kittens than she can find homes for, and yes, there is a certain odour inherent to such a collection. But it's not as though she lives in an apartment in Manhattan, at least not anymore. And when she did, all she had were the birds. She's not a fool, for God's sake. Anna lives in a small cottage outside a remote village on the edge of the Black Forest. Who cares if her animals run rampant? The neighbours, apparently, and the town council. She has been thumbing her nose at them for years, insisting that they have no say in how she keeps her house or cares for her pets. Now she can see they've had their vengeance at last. Anna can tolerate the fact that Prince Frederick has had her home cleared of rubbish. He left a note apologizing for the necessity, but she cannot forgive him for allowing the town to gas and cremate her animals. 62 cats. She knew each and every one of their names, and 4 dogs. Murdered, gone, euthanized, and turned to ashes. At first, when Anna saw the burn pile behind the house, she assumed that was where they discarded the trash. But she only realized its true purpose when she found the charred collar. Anna raised baby from a puppy, and now all that is left of him is a bit of burnt leather and a crumpled metal tag with his name. Frederick could have saved baby. He could have made this one exception. But he didn't, and Anna will never forgive him for it. Anna says goodbye to no one. Certainly not Frederick. She simply makes a phone call.
"I am ready. Come get me."
This has always been part of the plan, but what has happened here over the last several days has forced her to move more quickly. When there is a long pause on the other end, Anna realizes that she has not bothered with pleasantries or given her name.
After a moment, she adds, "This is Anna."
"Yes, I gathered that."
The man clears his throat.
"It was my impression that you didn't want to leave for a few more months, that you had other plans."
"They have ransacked my house and killed my animals."
A curse, and then, "Bastards."
"That is a far too gentle word."
She clenches her fist, then releases it, flexing her fingers wide.
"When can I expect you?"
"An hour. Maybe less."
"I'll be waiting at the road."
Anna grabs a pile of rumpled clothing, giving little thought to what she stuffs in the leather valise. Apart from that, she takes only the chess set, her penknife, the photo album, and the icon. Inside the hollow statue is a set of carefully rolled documents, some legal, some forged. For all the accusations that she is slovenly, Anna can find exactly what she needs when she needs it. She tucks the items neatly inside her bag, then turns her back on the cottage that has been her home for 22 years. The driveway is long and winding, and she staggers under the weight of her valise. She is a small woman, grown weak with age, but her anger pushes her forward, one indignant step at a time. Anna is out of breath and red-faced by the time she shuffles to a stop beside the mailbox and plops down on a stump, exhausted. She doesn't have to wait long. Faster than promised, he soon slows to a stop beside her in a government issue vehicle. The man who steps out is tall and dark and wears an official-looking suit. He opens the door for her, then takes her valise and sets it in the trunk of the car.
"Thank you, Tartar."
He slides behind the wheel and looks at her in the rearview mirror.
"Why do you call me that? I've always meant to ask."
Anna thinks for a moment, then laughs. Her first real laugh since waking up in the hospital at Neuenberg.
"You know, I can't remember."
It's a lie, of course. Anna does not forget. Her memory is as sound and as solid as a gun safe. And just as impenetrable. But she can't very well tell this man that she gave him the nickname because she once watched him eat a steak so rare that a puddle of blood collected on his plate. It reminded her of beef tartare. Tartare became Tartar, and that has been his name ever since. Nor does Anna tell him that she has labelled people for as long as she can remember, given them monikers, as both a way to remember all these names and faces that have been forced upon her through the decades, and a means of reminding herself of their true nature, in case she's tempted to lower her defences. And it has worked. The heiress and the duck and the private investigator are proof of this. Tartar is just one in a long list of bynames. He might be loyal, but she does not want to forget that he is a man with a taste for blood.
"Are you hungry?" he asks after they've driven a few miles. "It will take us several hours to drive to Frankfurt. We can stop and eat on the way."
"I'm fine for now, just drive. I want to leave this place."
"Trust me, Tsarevna. You'll be in America before they even know you've left."
Tartar hands her the visa and plane ticket, only once they've reached the airport.
"You will fly from Frankfurt to Dulles," he says. "You will have a 2-hour layover in Washington, but you mustn't leave the airport. You have no time to sightsee. None whatsoever. I know how you are with gardens and monuments, but you'll have to resist this time. You can come back later. Just go directly to your gate and wait for your flight to Charlottesville. Gleb will meet you at the gate."
Gleb Botkin. So it has come to this. She hasn't seen him in many years, and they have both grown old in the meantime. He married and had children and became a widower. Anna feels guilty that she is grateful for this, but she couldn't go to him if his wife was still living. It would be too strange with their history. Anna regrets the way she kept Gleb at arm's length, unable to surrender to his affections. But his mistake in Wasserburg was the beginning of everything going wrong.
Had it not been for the private investigator, she would have proved her case before the courts long ago, and she wouldn't have spent decades living in a ramshackle cottage waiting for the verdict of her appeal. She would have a title and an estate and the dispersed fortune of Tsar Nicholas II of Russia. 1 month earlier. Unterlengenhardt, Germany. July 1968. Baby lays his head on the hard knob of Anna's knee. This is a thing he has done since he was a puppy. Whenever he finds her sitting for more than 10 seconds at a time, he plops down on his haunches, drops his chin to her knee, and sighs like an arthritic old man. When Anna first found him on the side of the road with his siblings, he was sick and skinny with the mange, one eye swollen shut, the runt of the litter. She didn't know that he was mostly Irish wolfhound, and would grow so large that he would nearly reach her shoulder. In hindsight, she should have guessed. His paws were almost the size of her hand, even then. But the rest of him was so scrawny and emaciated, she didn't pay attention. Now, 11 years later, he is a shaggy, bearded, gentle giant. He's a shadow, with eyes the colour of a copper penny and a huge, pink, wagging tongue. He is a beautiful dog, despite the fact that he hasn't been groomed in years, and has grown quite matted around the edges. He is ridiculous, but she loves him entirely. At this point in Anna's life, Baby is the closest thing she has to a real friend. Everyone else objects to the cats. This train of thought has put Anna into a gloomy frame of mind, and she wants a change of scenery. Come, Baby, let's check the mail. She wraps her hand around his collar, and he pulls back on his hind legs, giving her a little tug, the smallest boost, to get her out of the chair. She's moving more slowly these days, fighting a constant series of aches and pains. Anna and Baby meander down the drive. The dog walks in large, lazy circles around her, sniffing at plants and trees, lifting his leg at any large rock in his path. Anna takes her time, allowing herself the simple luxury of stretching tight muscles and letting the sun warm her face. There are two letters in the mailbox, one from Gleb Botkin and the other from Maria Rasputin. Anna scowls when she sees the overly elegant feminine handwriting on the latter. All that looping, swirling calligraphy, the telltale marks of a woman who is trying too hard. She understands this to a degree. The years cannot have been any kinder to Grigory Rasputin's daughter than they have been to her. "That woman needs to stop writing me," Anna says. Baby looks up as though she has addressed him directly. Baby nudges her in the hip with his cold, wet nose. It leaves a damp mark on her cotton skirt. He's telling her it's time to go back to the house. The dog herds her as though she is a child. Anna turns obediently, and they begin the slow ascent back up the drive. Not only has Anna never responded to Maria's letters, she hasn't read any of them. They are on the bookshelf, tucked between two cumbersome German law tomes that she found at a yard sale in the village. It was a rash purchase, a half-hearted attempt to navigate the legal system and her endless series of court cases and appeals. Once they get back to the cottage, Anna retrieves the other letters from the shelf, evicts an orange pregnant cat from her chair, and settles in to finally see what devilry the woman is up to. Maria Rasputin is long-winded, prone to flattery, and impressed with her own vocabulary. She also has a frenzied need to insert herself into Anna's life. She wants to visit, and, though she hasn't stated it directly, is now insinuating an unnecessary concern for Anna. She's wondering why Anna hasn't responded to her other missives, and she has floated the idea that she might pop in one day soon to check on her. Anna finds it quite interesting that even though Maria has gone to some trouble to dig up her address, it is not publicly listed. She has not been forthcoming with her own. The return address on each of the three letters shows only a post office box in Straubing. Whether or not she actually lives there, Maria Rasputin is sending her letters from the hinterlands of Germany. There are no circumstances under which Anna will willingly entertain the woman, and since an answer to this quandary does not immediately present itself, she moves on to Gleb's letter. His handwriting is as familiar as her own, a gentle, non-pretentious scrawl that loses steam at the end of each line and squiggles into nothing, as if he can't remember what he meant to say next, not unlike the man himself. Gleb's letter is short. He wants her to come visit him in the United States. He has made a friend, some professor by the name of Dr. Jack Manahan, who has just retired from the University of Virginia, and they've come up with a plan to have her declared, finally, as Anastasia Romanoff. What Anna finds interesting is that inside Gleb's letter is another short note from Jack Manahan himself, offering to be her host. He never comes out and directly mentions her financial woes, but he says that she won't need to be concerned about a place to live if she chooses to accept the invitation. His home is available to her. And knowing she might question his motives, he lays them out plainly. Jack is an academic who specializes in genealogy and family history. On a broader level, he wants to set the record straight about her identity, and on a personal level, doing so would be the crowning accomplishment of his career. He's honest enough to admit that outright. She carefully folds the letters up the way they came and tucks them back in the envelopes. Anna grins at the thought of this new opportunity. She is more than willing to let them fight on her behalf. 3 days later, Anna posts a letter accepting Gleb's invitation. By her calculations, it won't reach him for at least a month, what with the glacial pace of international mail. His letter took a similar length of time to arrive, and she feels the wait will be good for him. Let him fret and pace for a change. Once back at the cottage, Anna makes a phone call. "Hello," she says once the man on the other end answers. "I'm going to need a visa." The conversation is short and to the point. She has known Tartar for years, but has never heard him speak more than 3 sentences at a time. "Thank you," she says, when he assures her the request will be processed immediately. "Anything for you, Tsarevna." Anna imagines him sitting behind that large, bureaucratic desk, bowing at the neck. The thought makes her laugh. The lightness of her mood is interrupted by a car speeding up the driveway. It comes to an abrupt stop before her door, slinging gravel against the window where she sits. Anna can see a hairline fracture spread out at the corner of one pane, not 5 inches from her face. All is still and silent for one long breath. Then 2 car doors creak open and slam shut simultaneously. Anna's hips ache constantly these days, as does a single vertebra in the small of her back. But neither of these maladies stops her from sliding out of the chair like a lizard, then crawling toward the front door. She pushes the lock into place seconds before the pounding begins.
"Anna, I know you're in there. Are you okay?"
A woman's voice, disingenuous and in Russian. Not concerned enough to call first, or to alert the authorities, or to send a doctor. Not even troubled enough to summon anyone to check on her. No, this is an ambush, and Anna won't play along. Across the room, Baby lifts his head from the rug and begins to growl, low and deep. It reverberates through the floorboards and into Anna's palms. She raises a calming hand to him and whispers, "I'm okay." But he strains forward anyway, suspicious. After a short, silent pause, he heaves to his feet and pads to the door, his long nails clacking against the wood. He sniffs twice, listens for a moment to the shuffling on the other side, and releases a series of thunderous barks.
"Did you receive my letters?"
The woman is now shouting to be heard. Of course it would be a Rasputin at the door. Anna sets a hand on Baby's head. He drops back onto his haunches, tail wagging. Another woman speaks, but in English, and not to Anna.
"Look at this place," she says. "I've not seen anything like it outside of a third world country."
Maria Rasputin answers in English, and they begin the thoughtless, self-righteous sort of conversation usually inflicted on the feeble-minded and the impoverished. If they intend to be secretive, they have failed. Anna lived in the United States for many years and speaks fluent English.
"I hear she's always been fond of cats," Maria Rasputin says. "The smell is impressive."
"We're dealing with an eccentric. Keep that in mind. We must coddle her. In this case, flattery will get you everywhere. When she opens the door, make a point to bow and call her Tsarevna. Use her full name, Anastasia, as often as possible."
I'm not convinced she's home.
"Oh, she is. The trouble is getting her to let us in."
Finally, after they have knocked and pleaded and called to her, one of them leans against the door. Anna can hear it groan under her weight.
"She's not answering. What do we do now?"
There is a ruthless note to Maria Rasputin's voice when she answers.
"We have to flush her out."
"And how, pray tell, are we going to do that?"
"It's a pity anyone is forced to live under these conditions," Maria says loudly in German, and with a note of obscene pleasure. "I think a call to the town council is in order, don't you? Surely this has to be a health hazard."
"You devious old harpy.
Takes one to know one, but you should be nice to me, Patty. I'm your meal ticket."
"I thought you said she was our meal ticket."
"Well, you don't get to her without me, now do you?"
Anna listens as the two of them bicker, now in English, and walk back toward the car. The last thing she hears before the doors shut is this strange woman, Patty, Maria called her, say, "I'm beginning to doubt whether anyone can get to her."
Baby growls again as the car roars to life, and he sends them off with another ear-splitting round of barks.
"Enough," Anna says, swatting at him. "I'll go deaf if you keep that up."
It takes her a moment to get off the floor, and by the time she makes it to the window, her visitors have already disappeared down the drive. Within the week, Anna gets three surprise visits from the health department. Each time they knock on the door, she stays hidden within the house, only to rip the citation up and throw it away once they've left. She has been ordered to clean up the property. They are concerned about the cats and the garbage and the piles of books and boxes they can see in the windows. They are concerned about her health. There's been a report. She's ill. Damn that Rasputin. And they want to check on her. Anna doesn't know much German law, but she does know they can't actually enter her home without a warrant or a doctor's order, unless they can see that she is incapacitated. The following week, people begin to arrive in one fretting group after another. They come in twos and threes and peek in the windows and bang on the door. They slip notes under the door and beg her to come out. They don't bother lowering their voices as they talk about her health and the condition of the cottage. They malign the animals as though any of this is their fault, and they disparage Anna herself. At first she doesn't open the door to them because she is suspicious. Now she keeps it closed because she's angry. It is easy enough to barricade herself inside the cottage, to let her world shrink to a pinprick. The cats come and go at their leisure through a small pet door at the back. Anna lets baby out twice a day to do his business. Mostly her days are filled with reading. Letters and old newspapers and tedious volumes of German law, things she's been meaning to get to for years. She eats what is in the house, giving little thought to preparation or taste or expiration date. At first she doesn't mind the stomach ache. It's easy enough to pass off as indigestion. Only when the aching turns to cramping and the sweat turns to chills a day later does Anna begin to consider the possibility of food poisoning. But in this new feverish state, the only word that makes any sense to her at all is poison. and she begins to fear and then believe that she has actually been poisoned. Anna spends one long, tortured night walking a path between the bedroom and the bathroom, making a mental list of all the people who want her dead. If she were not afraid of actually dying, she might laugh. The list is obscenely long. Baby presses his nose against Anna's cheek, trying to rouse her. It isn't cold and wet the way a dog's nose should be, but dry and warm and rough. And even in her condition, Anna knows that he is dehydrated. Anna also knows that she is very ill. She vacillates wildly between hot and cold. She's thirsty but not hungry. Anna is very tired and wants to stay exactly where she is, in her slender bed in her crowded bedroom beneath the window, curled up in a glorious patch of sunlight. It feels good on her old, thin skin. She feels as though the sun is coming directly through, warming her blood. If she opened her mouth, she could taste the warmth itself, drink it in. It would be like citrus, sour and explosive. It would make her mouth pucker, and her entire body would shudder a bit with the sensation. The hairs on her arms would stand to attention. The sun is a lemon hanging in the sky. Floating fruit, flaming fruit, hotter now on her cheek, uncomfortably so. The lemon is burning her. She should roll over to her other side, but her left arm has gone numb beneath the weight of her body, and she can't quite get her limbs to cooperate and shift her around. Oh well, the sun lemon will fall lower in the sky eventually. It will drop from its celestial tree, and her cheek will stop hurting then. Baby barks, loud in her ear. He nudges her. A groan is all she can muster in reply. Anna assumes he wants to be let out, and she feels guilty that she can't get up and open the door for him. If he messes the floor, she'll just clean it up later. He pads away and barks again, louder this time, incessantly. Now she's angry. Be quiet, she thinks. I can't take care of you right now. I can't even take care of myself. That's what mothers are for, to take care of you. Anna wants her mother suddenly. Badly. She has reverted full circle to a child, curled on her bed, crying for her mother, wanting to be soothed and have the pain taken away. There is a pain somewhere in her abdomen, and it begins to bloom, brighter and bigger now that she's aware of it. Mother, she moans, and baby goes berserk. He throws himself against the front door. And then there are the sounds of splintering wood and breaking glass, voices, footsteps, rough hands that shake and poke her. Anna screams. She thrashes. There is an acute, needle-like pain at her left wrist. And then all is devoured by darkness.
Chapter 4. Anastasia. Citizen Romanov. 1917. Alexander Palace, Tsarskoye Selo, Russia. March 9th. When my father finally returns home, none of us go out to greet him. We've been trained to wait for the trumpets, for the choreographed footfalls of 100 officers in full regalia. That's the point at which we're allowed to throw wide the front doors and line up in our finery. When our father makes an entrance, we are to be accessories, ornamental figures meant to enhance his glory. But no one has ever bothered to tell us what role to play should he come home disgraced and despondent. So when Nikolai Alexandrovich Romanov II, Tsar of all Russia, is brought back to the Alexander Palace, unshaven, in a common carriage, under armed guard, we are nowhere to be seen. He finds us in the parlour, staring at the fire, our spirits waning. I look up, and there he is, standing in the door, the toe of one muddy boot resting on the Persian rug. For just a moment, he looks like a god, tall and strong and surrounded by light. This is my father,
and he has come home, and I could burst with joy at the sight of him. I am too stunned, too relieved to speak. But then he steps forward, and I realize that he is not at all the man I have known. Or perhaps he is simply a man, and not the emperor I remember him to be. I was tricked by the light, and by my own hope, for he is weary and haggard, looking every bit the mortal. It's all there in the lines around his eyes and the stubble along his cheekbones, the impressive moustache that he always takes such pains to wax and curl, hangs limp at the corners of his mouth.
Nicky.
Mother sees him next, but she does not rise from her chair or throw herself into his arms. It's as though she's a puppet, and whatever strings keep her up are snipped by invisible scissors. Mother collapses in upon herself and goes quietly to pieces right there on the couch. Father can barely get her name out without choking on a sob of his own.
Alex,
he says, eyes full of a rare softness and longing. Alexei flies at him, all elbows and knees, large eyes, pale skin, bright freckles. He is 12, but he looks like he's 2, the way he wraps himself around Father and buries his face in his chest. My sisters rush him, and Father can't scoop them up quickly enough. I am the last to approach, and he does not see me for several long moments because his eyes are squeezed tight. But when he does, he utters a single sentence, and some shattered thing inside me is pieced back together.
Schwipsig,
he whispers.
Come here.
I throw myself into his arms, unable to stop a sudden frightful wave of tears. The caterwauling and celebrating is extraordinary, and the remaining servants come running from all directions in panic. I can't blame them. It does sound as though someone is being slaughtered right there on the floor, but then Father slowly extricates himself from the pile of children, and they see him. I've never realized before how clearly men need leaders, how adrift we are without them, and how the mere sight of one can breathe courage into a room. The servants' cheers are different, elated and filled with expectation, whooping and hollering and whistling. All will be well now that their sovereign has returned. They believe this. I can hear it in every jubilant shout, and for one perfect moment, I forget that we are under siege. But then a sharp official rap sounds on the parlor door, and we lift tear-stained faces to find a soldier standing in the doorway. Behind him are 3 more, all of them uncomfortable and stoic. One of them looks to be about my age.
Alexander Kerensky is waiting for you in the formal reception room downstairs, the soldier says.
Father straightens his collar. He gives us a reassuring smile.
I'll be back shortly. I want to hear everything that's happened while I was gone. Kerensky has requested that your family come as well. He wishes to speak with all of you at once.
Father studies us for a moment. We are wilted and exhausted, wrung out from fear and waiting. Olga and Tatiana, though recovered from their bout with measles, are blanched and painfully thin. Alexei has a grey tint to his skin, and his hair hasn't been brushed in days. Maria, though pretty as always, is disheveled, and Mother's hair has slipped from her pins, giving her a harried schoolmarmish appearance. God only knows how frightful I look. Father clearly is not impressed by what he sees.
Kerensky can wait a few moments, he says. We'll be down shortly.
Father closes the parlor door and says to us,
Come along and freshen up. We have an appearance to make.
This, at least, is familiar. We are handed off to Dover to make ourselves as presentable as possible, while Father slips away to shave. Mother situates herself in front of a gilded mirror and wrestles her wayward hair under control. It doesn't take long, in the end, to have our hair combed and our faces scrubbed. Dover yanks dresses from the wardrobe at random and pulls them over our heads while we shove our feet into tight, pointy-toed shoes. Alexei is given the sailor suit he wore last year, but he's lost so much weight from his illness that it fits him again. We assemble again 15 minutes later,
and while not entirely dignified, at least we no longer look ragged. Father pulls open the parlor door, glares at the soldiers standing guard, and walks toward the grand staircase with all the dignity he can muster. Mother rises graciously from her seat and follows him down the great wide steps. We go after them. First Olga, tall and beautiful. I can feel the soldiers watching her. I can almost feel them smile. Tatiana goes next, the air stirred by her perfume and the muttered words of appreciation from Kerensky's men. Maria is only a step behind, statuesque and aloof, her chin held high, certain of her place as the prettiest of us, certain they will look at her the longest. I bring up the rear with Alexei at my side, just as we've been taught. He, the little heir, and me, the guardian. I wrap an arm around his thin shoulders and slow my steps to match his. I do not glance at the soldiers, and I'm certain that none of them bothers to take much note of my presence, other than to complete a headcount. 7 Romanovs. 7 captives. The formal reception room is the sunniest in the entire palace, and therefore my favorite. It is where we have our art lessons and, in the absence of visitors, where we sprawl about reading in the summertime. The room sits in the bottom right corner of the palace, near our parents' suite, and has 7 enormous ornate windows that overlook the park. The walls are covered, floor to ceiling, in white artificial marble and topped by ornate entablature that Father once told me cost a king's ransom to install. I dared not ask then, much less now, what it cost to ransom a king. The rear wall of the reception room showcases 2 of the most valuable paintings on the entire grounds. Detai's Cossacks, an enormous canvas spanning almost 10 feet that details the famed march during Napoleon's Russian campaign, and Vigée Le Brun's infamous Marie Antoinette and her children. My family always has bordered on being Francophiles, I'm afraid. We've spent so many hours with our tutor, Pierre Gilliard, discussing the differences between neoclassical and academic painting styles that I can recite the differences on command, and in French, no less. Impressive, I suppose, unless you consider that I'm 15 years old and cannot lace my own boots without assistance from Dover. The paintings have been hung, so they will be seen immediately upon entering the room. Most visitors are speechless at the sight of them. But the man who sits at a small round table beneath the chandelier seems impervious to their spell. He does not rise or bow as we approach, but rather waits, one arm draped over the back of his chair. He wears a high-collared suit instead of the military uniform I expect. Kerensky is a lean, pale man with short, dark hair that forms a widow's peak in the middle of his forehead. His dark eyes are nearly obscured by thick brows, and the combination gives him a distinctly hostile appearance. Alexei squeezes my hand, and I can feel the bird-like pulse at his wrist, that tiny strumming thread of fear. He looks paler than usual, and is trembling because he has just noticed the bayonets. Mother passes 2 armed guards, chin held high in disdain. Then my sisters in their gowns and ridiculous shoes follow behind her. Alexei and I bring up the rear, eyes wide. Both guards hold a rifle, their bayonets affixed and polished to a malicious shine. Now that I've seen them, I cannot look away. I stare at them as we pass, noting the unholy sheen at each pointed end.
"You are scaring my family,"
Father growls the moment he comes to a stop before the seated man. It is his angered voice that grounds me.
"Perhaps they could do with some fear," Kerensky says, his voice rich and confident. There is no hint of triumph or pride there, simply a calm assurance that we will do as we are told. "Your family has long since forgotten their place."
I can hear the snap of Father's jaw from 15 feet away, the way he forces his teeth together to stop an imperious retort. Instead, he introduces this stranger.
"This is Alexander Kerensky, Minister of Justice. There's no need to stand before him, children. Please, take a seat. Father moves to the window and looks over the snow-covered gardens while Mother takes her place in a chair beside him. The rest of us find our usual seats around the room, my sisters each on their favorite chaise, and Alexei and I in the red and gold brocade armchair beside the fireplace. My feet do not touch the floor, and I hate that this cruel man notes it immediately, his gaze going straight to the toes of my beaded slippers as they dangle 3 inches from the rug. I hate him from that moment on. I hate him for making me feel small and vulnerable and so different from my elegant sisters. Nicholas, he says finally, with a curt nod toward my father. Not Tsar, not Your Majesty, not even Nikolai, but Nicholas. The barbaric English version of his name, Nicholas the Citizen, Nicholas the Prisoner. Father makes a show of sitting now and folding his hands theatrically in his lap. I see you've made yourself comfortable. Kerensky's face betrays no emotion. Let us be frank. Alexander Palace is no longer under your control, and I do not need your permission to enter, much less sit. I see that mutiny has added nothing to your manners, Father says. You find yourself in a revolution and complain there are no manners? I find myself in my home with company I did not invite and do not welcome. You are in a palace that belongs to the Russian people. As of today, you and your family are prisoners. You may not leave, and you may not speak to anyone from the outside. From the corner of my eye, I see Mother reach for Father's sleeve with a trembling hand. This should not come as a surprise. We've had no contact with the outside world for 9 days, but still, to hear the truth from Kerensky is unnerving. Yet I am not afraid. Perhaps I should be. My siblings certainly are. But the only thing I feel at this pronouncement is anger. I am like my father in that way, I fear. Anger first, reason second. Kerensky gives us a moment to let this sink in, then continues. The stubborn loyalty of your household is regrettable, but those who desire to leave have 48 hours. Any who stay longer will be under house arrest with you and your family. They will share whatever fate awaits you. No, Father shakes his head. Our servants have nothing to do with this. They should be left alone. You have been arrested. You have no say and nothing with which to negotiate. You have abdicated the throne, not only for yourself, but for your son as well. You are no longer emperor. Anything granted to you is by my good grace alone. Father maintains his composure at this disclosure, but Mother draws in a sharp breath and digs her fingernails into the fine wool of Father's sleeve. Oh, I see. You haven't told them yet. Let me make it clear, then. Kerensky turns a cruel, thin-lipped smile to each of us in turn. He pauses to make sure we're paying attention. I want to glance at my sisters to read their expressions, but force myself to remain still. When Kerensky looks at me, I sit up defiantly, my spine stretched to its full length, trying to be braver than I really am, trying to radiate defiance. As of 3 days ago, you are no longer the royal family of Russia. Your only title is that of prisoner. If Mother looked pale and weak before, she is stricken now, stunned into silence. You are citizens now, Kerensky says, each and every one of you. And it is only out of respect for the past that you will not be sent to a citizen's prison. Instead, you will stay here in the Alexander Palace under house arrest until other arrangements can be made. Your rooms will be limited, as will your activities. Your servants will be few, and you will be supervised at all times. I will personally oversee your schedule, and you will adhere to it without question or complaint. The sooner you accept this, the easier it will be for all of you. How long? Mother's voice is thin and reedy, so she clears her throat and tries again. How long will this last? Kerensky studies her.
She has grown thinner since father left, but not in a healthy way. Her cheeks look like paste. Her hair is dull. The skin at the back of her hands lies wrinkled and loose against her bones. If I knew Kerensky better, I would say that the look on his face is one of pity. But I do not yet know what sort of man he is, so I cannot place the expression. He takes a step forward and bends over Mother's chair, speaking as though she is an imbecile child and not Alexandra Fyodorovna, granddaughter of Queen Victoria and Empress Consort of Russia.
Have you not realized it yet? This is never going to end. 3 days ago, my train was stopped at Malaya Vishera,
Father says. Now that Kerensky has returned to his soldiers, Father gathers us around the fire to explain his abdication.
Revolutionaries crowded the line and forced the train to stop. The routes to Petrograd and Sarskoye Selo were closed, and we were diverted to Pskov. I was met there by Alexander Kerensky and a delegation from the Duma. They brought a declaration of abdication with them. There was little conversation about me signing. It was expected that I do so without argument.
You fought them. Please, tell me you fought them at least, Mother says, her voice strangled.
For what? My honor, the country, the military? Would you have me face a firing squad right there on the tracks to preserve those things?
I would have you do it for Alexei, Mother snaps, her composure thin and brittle. He looks at my brother with lips pressed firmly together. Whatever he might say to Mother in private will not be uttered out loud in front of their son. This is their ongoing argument, the fissure that hisses and spits between them. Mother believes, without qualification, the word of Grigory Rasputin that Alexei has been healed, and she will not be convinced otherwise. She has repeated this assurance to my brother, therefore it is a fact and will not be denied in her hearing. The price Mother paid for this promise is too great. It is unspeakable. It has cost her reputation and, many whisper, her honor as well. We are forbidden to speak of Alexei's condition, neither in his hearing nor at any other time. The only time my mother ever struck me was when I dared to question Rasputin's claims while Alexei suffered from a 3-day nosebleed. She split my lip with the emerald ring on the back of her hand. And while Mother never apologized for the blow, she did stop wearing the large princess-cut emerald. I like to think that means she's sorry. Father, however, is a man of logic, and he believes the physicians. His son might live for many years, but the hemophilia will never be cured, and Alexei will never father children of his own. In the end, he answers Mother, but does not look at her.
Fighting was a risk I could not take. Alexei's life is too important.
So is his birthright.
Had I fought them, we would all be dead right now. None of you would have lived through that night. Can you understand this? I did the best I could.
My mother was born to the name Alex Victoria Helena Louise Beatrice of Hesse and by Rhine. Only upon her reception into the Russian Orthodox Church and subsequent marriage to my father was she given the name Alexandra Feodorovna. She is a dual German and British duchess, and she is more proud of her beautiful children than any other thing in her life, including her own title. Beauty is power, and power is all she knows. To have 4 fair daughters gives her an advantage over every other royal family in Europe. The fact that she has rounded out her brood with Alexei, a male heir for the Romanov dynasty, gives her a satisfaction and sense of superiority unrivaled among her peers. To have all of this stripped from her in an afternoon is unthinkable. Mother, finally, is at a loss for words. The consequences of Father's abdication are finally occurring to my brother, however. He springs from the chair beside me.
Don't I have a say? He demands.
No.
But I'm the Tsarevich.
You are a child.
I am not. I'm a man. All the officers say so.
He stamps his foot in rage.
You should have asked me.
Father sighs. The officers coddle you. And besides, the decision was not yours to make. It was mine, and it is done.
But what about my soldiers and my regiments?
Alexei demands.
Won't I see them again?